access number 29045, Mr. Keith Glover, Reel 4. Now, what happened when you finished at Compton Basin? This is December 1954.
We had embarkation leave, and we're put...
Now, did you know you were going on overseas program?
Oh, yes.
When did they tell you that?
At Compton Basin, we were all summoned together in a large building, and an officer said, how many of you want home postings? Well, the majority of us put our hands up.
Lots of reasons, but I mean, why not at overseas? Some people like overseas, other people...
I suppose because of my ties to Melton Mowbray. It was not a big town, and I knew zillions of people, and I was heavily committed socially in the band, football, cricket, etc., etc. And didn't really want to cut that cord. So, as I've just said, most of us raised a hand to indicate that we wanted, in fact, all of us did except one. I remember him now. He'd signed on for 3 years, because that meant extra money. And he was the only one that raised his hand for an overseas posting. And again, what I'm about to tell you is true. He was the only one that got a home posting. The rest of us were told we were going overseas. At that stage, we didn't know where. But we were told...
How do you feel about that?
Well, having been told we're going overseas, I thought, well, that's it. There were lots of places to go, and there were some places I didn't want to go, because in theory, although the Korean War had finished, they were still taking pot shots at each other. And there was some nonsense in Africa with the Mau Mau, and there was nonsense in Malaysia with the communist bandits. So I thought, well, I don't really want to go where they're shooting at people.
Now, did you know where you were going before you went on embarkation leave?
No, and I didn't even know where we were going when we got to the transit camp, which was RAF Changi, near Singapore.
Right, well, hang on. So what about your embarkation leave? What was that like?
Ooh, that was good. Drank a bit, played a lot. Mum made me go out in uniform because it was warmer than any other clothes I got, and it was quite chilly. I wasn't particularly enamoured with that, but in those days the streets were full of men in uniform anyway, so you didn't stick out as you do today. And we were told that we'd got to take a suit of civvies with us, because we would be flying by civilian aircraft. Well, I talked to Dad. He said, well, I suppose you could be going to an embassy if you want the civvies. And I thought, well, that's a thought, isn't it? Wouldn't mind that. So cometh the hour, and I've forgotten where I have to report, Blackbush Aerodrome. Hermes, the aircraft, flying for, Airworks.
That was a firm.
Yeah, it did all the military stuff. So we get there and in civvies and get on this four-engine plane.
Had you flown before? I mean...
No, not at all.
And that was the norm at the time?
Hmm. Yeah, zillions of airmen have never been in an aeroplane to this day.
Now, what was your flight like?
Well, we took off, and we got to the Alps, and had to come back because the wings iced up, and it just couldn't get over the Alps. Oh, the bloody stroll on, you know. And the directors where did they stick us? A little RAF station that was just like a hotel. It was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I went to the pictures, I can remember that. Saw Glynis Johns, I can remember that. She was a mermaid, I can remember that. And then we tried again next day and managed to get over there. We got as far as Nicosia, where we refueled.
This is December still, is it?
Yeah, oh yeah. And I've forgotten all the staging posts. We flew through that. We stopped off at, was it Karachi, Calcutta, or Calcutta, Karachi,
I
think.
Were these overnight stops or just stops?
No, that first one was just a refuelling stop. The first overnight stop was Karachi, and that was Christmas Eve, in a big hotel. Then we went to Calcutta. That was another overnight stop. That would be Christmas Day.
Now, what were conditions like in the plane?
Non-existent. Just a seat. Bang. They must have had some stewardesses. I can't remember. They must have fed us. They couldn't have left us that long without some sort of food.
And what were these overnight stops like? Because you've never, presumably, never been out of the country.
No, no.
They're very different places.
Oh, my goodness me. These were... When think that we were still the Raj in India, and buses had special places for the natives. They weren't allowed to sit with us. So it was like being a lord. Quite enjoyed it.
How did you take to the Indian climate, Karachi, sorry, the climate?
Not too well. Strangely enough, people say their heat's, or anybody's heat's different to the heat we get. His heat is different to us. And it is a fact that once I got to my permanent posting, I quickly acclimatised to the heat.
We'll come back to that then.
Yeah.
Anything else about the flight then? So you've got as far as...
No, it's pretty boring. You know, it's like being on a bus for 4 days.
Was it only... I know it was a civilian flight, but were there civilians on it? Or was it?
No. All service personnel and... or their wives. Well, this is for the long-serving people, of course.
Now, what happened when you got to Changi? Is that wasn't your ultimate base?
No, that was a transit camp. And this is where we were given our final destinations. In fact, a very good friend of mine who had gone through square bashing and trade training with was put on an airplane and sent back to Ceylon, of all places. The guy in the next bed to me was woken up one morning, given a rifle and 10 rounds and sent up country to fight, to be where the bandits are. He wasn't going up there to fight them, but needed to be armed in case they shot at him. And then they gave me my ticket for Hong Kong, which I thought, well, right, that sounds pretty neat. We'll go and see what the chink's like.
What do you remember of Changi Transit Camp? What were you doing there? What was it like?
Well, we were doing nothing because we were in transit. We were just... I mean, the facilities were magnificent. Swimming pool out of this world, so we used to go swimming. It was very, very hot. And by this time, we were wearing KDs, so we were, for the time, properly attired. And that's all we did, just lounge about and eat and swim.
So how long were you there? Just a week or so?
Not more than a week. That's when I learned at that late stage that Changi had been a prisoner of war camp. The Japanese had incarcerated people there, including Ronald Searle. I understand some of his pictures are still on the walls there that he drew when he was a prisoner of war.
Now, so you were going to be sent to where? What was your unit called?
Signal section, RAF Kaitak, K-A-I-T-A-K, which actually was stationed on the Hong Kong airport. It's Kaitak airport. Runway 31 and 13. Runway 13 was diabolical. You approached it from the sea. If you overshot, you hit the mountain, because that was right at the end. Then if you came in on the mountain and overshot, you landed in the Ogin. So you had to be very careful when you put your airplane down.
That was runway 1 or 3.
It's 13, runway 13.
And how many runways were there?
There was a second one, which, as most airfields have, you know, virtually at right angles, not quite right angles, but it was never, ever used. I can't remember an airplane putting down on it at all. The approach was sloppy from either end of that.
So it was just a dangerous airport?
In my view, yes. We lost the pilot a month there for various reasons.
So what was the setup? What was your reception? You joined the signal section at Kaitak Airport. Mm. Now, what was the and that's an RAF base?
There is an RAF station on the airport. If you flew to Hong Kong today, you would go into Kaitak Aerodrome. It's been extended. The runway goes out into the sea now, so it can take big aircraft. Whether or not the RAF buildings are still standing, I really do not know. Some were Nissan huts, so I suspect they've gone. But there were huge barrack blocks as well, double deckers. They might still be there.
Now, what was your reception like? You're joining, you know, you're the new
wireless
mechanic. How did they take you in?
Civilly. You know, you'd go in into the office and you'd be asked details by a clerk of no great rank, name, rank, number, trade, and then they would shove you in the right direction on the camp. See, GWMR, ground wireless mechanic, receivers, it's no good sending this guy to the transmitting station. What they did do, however, was to send me to a squadron on the camp that flew Spitfires.
And still, in 55?
In 55, yes, indeed. Yeah. They were flying later than that. They were flying in the Mau Mau business.
Actually posted to the squadron?
I was then, when I got there. Wireless mechanic, they need a wireless mechanic. I've forgotten the number of the squadron. So off I go, and most of the mechs were Chinese civilians. So this little chinky man who spoke very good English took me to this Spitfire and said, service the radio. I didn't even know where the bloody thing was. And he sat me in the cockpit, and I'd got to call the tower up to do this, that and the other. And again, I'd got no clue what to do. It then dawned on the little Chinaman that perhaps I wasn't what he wanted. So within 2 hours, I was kicked back to the office and given my right posting, which was to intercommand receivers. This was a shack up a mountain next door to the officer's mess with radios I recognised immediately and I could handle.
Now, so tell me what was in this shack.
There was a huge board of fuses for a start, dozens of the big fuses, a table, a teleprinter, only they weren't called, yes there were teleprinters, and two banks of receivers, a bank of AKR-88s, a bank of CR-150s, and my job was to tune these intercommand signals in. I've still got some wonderful pictures that they used to send at Christmas time. They do Christmas trees with X's and things. Find the signal, identify it, and then patch it through to the guys on station that needed the signals. They were all groups of four letters, all in code.
The tuning into the signals we've discussed, how did you patch a signal through to something else?
You know these telephone plug things that old-fashioned telephone operators used to shove into a phone board? We get the little versions now, don't we, on earphones. Well, these were the big boys. So I'd jump one into the receiver, one into the teleprinter initially to identify that I'd got the correct signal, and then move it to the board that plugged it through to the station. And that was my job done. And then every 15 minutes I would monitor that system to make sure the signal was still good. What did we have? QRS, that was static garbage. QRM, that was radio interference. QSB was a signal strength. There were about eight different ones. I can't remember them all now. And like I say, every 15 minutes we had to monitor the signal. And if it went crook, then I'd have to inform them and we'd change frequency, find a better frequency for the signal. So I read hundreds of novels because there was nothing else to do.
So once you'd done it, I mean, how many of these signals would be coming through? I mean, how many were you monitoring?
Only one.
So a signal would come in, and that would last for how long?
Perhaps a whole shift, you know, 4 to 6 hours.
And that signal would be churning the numbers.
Coming in all the time. Probably not with a message for most of the time, just a carrier wave. And you knew when it was sending a message because the sound changed. It sort of burbled when there was an actual message on the carrier wave.
And then once you've done it, you patch in to the right thing, and then
put the kettle on.
Quarter of an hour.
Yeah.
You test it.
Yeah.
And that's it.
That's it.
And that's not much of a job.
Not much of a job.
I presume someone had to do it, but so. Did you get bored, or was it?
No, because I used to read in those days, and it gave me plenty of time to read.
So what would you read? I mean,
Mickey Spillane and books. He's just died, by the way, Mickey Spillane, and books like that. Crosswords. I used to do crossword puzzles. I didn't get bored. That's a fact.
And nobody minded you doing that, because sometimes in a job you could read. Or do a crossword puzzle, but you're not allowed to.
Yeah. No, it was common practice.
Was there anyone else in this office or shack or whatever?
No, that was the other beauty of it. When I got there, I was an AC1. Once I'd passed my trade training, I got my Sparks badge. You're automatically promoted to AC1. When I got to Kai Tak, you couldn't stand a shift on your own below the rank of LAC, so I was immediately promoted to LAC. In order that I could go on duty, on watch. And that's where I stayed. I didn't bother to go any further with it. Some of the guys did, SAC.
And how long was the shift?
We worked a Far East system. It's the best one that's ever been devised. Now, if I can remember it correctly, we'd work 7:30 in the morning till 12:30. Then you'd go on at 10:30 that same night and work through till 7:30 the next morning. Then you'd have all of that day off, all of the next day, and go in on the next day at 12:30 to work till 5:30. Now, wait a minute, there's something wrong there. That's not mating up. 7:30. It might have been 2:30 till 7:30. They should all match up.
I've got an idea of that. This suited you.
Oh yeah, it suited everybody. And pet foods. When I worked there, shifts were a fortnight. So if you were on afternoons for a fortnight, you know, you might just as well be dead. Then they altered it, and they've got a very similar system where they do a day of something, a day of something else, a day of something else, and the body clock never gets disturbed. So it meant that when I came off duty at 7:30 in the morning, I'd nip down to the mess, have a breakfast, and then I'd get changed and go downtown. Didn't go to bed until it was bedtime at night. Didn't need to.
Now, were there any other duties you had to do on a shift? Anything else you were required or meant to be?
No, nothing at all. The aerials, obviously very, very important, had their own aerial riggers. So if out went wrong with the aerials, it wasn't my job. My only job was to do exactly what I've told you there.
All mains. What about repair? Just going wrong.
Yeah, some things did go wrong.
What type of thing would go
well,
wrong?
Well, a fuse blew. And I've told you about this huge bank of fuses. Sod's Law, it was the last one I took out that had gone. I had to stand on the table to reach them. On another occasion, I went to change one and I picked myself up off the floor the other side of the shack. I managed to electrocute myself and it chucked me across. I obviously chose the wrong fuse. The receivers behaved themselves while I was there.
So it's just changing fuses?
Yeah.
Nothing else?
I used to sometimes. There was a civvy I met in Hong Kong, and he asked me if I'd mend his record player, so I took that up to the shack when I was on nights and mended that for him. Things like that.
Now, what about your NCOs and officers? Do you see much of them?
Yes. It's a different ball game now, of course. The NCOs are not DIs. Your senior NCOs, salt of the earth. I mean, you treated them with respect. You called them sergeant, or if it was a flight sergeant, we called them chiefs, chief technicians. And the corporals were just one of the boys. The officer, Flight Lieutenant Ierson, I can remember his name to this day, he just sat in his little office and kept his nose clean and kept out of our way, and we kept out of his. I saw him.
Was he actually doing anything? Did he have a role?
I really don't know. I suppose they had to have a titular head of the department, as it is. The only time I spoke at length with him was when I was about due for DMOB, and he called me in to interview me for my release and said, are you going to sign on? I said, I don't think so, sir.
We'll come back to that. Now, what about, how many were there doing this job then? How many, you're all leading aircraft, and that's the most junior you can be.
Yeah.
So who else is there? How many leading aircraft? How many NCOs?
There was a corporal in charge of us all, who used to stand watches like the rest of us. We did four shifts. There'd be eight of us, I suppose, doing this.
And then the officer.
And then Flight Lieutenant Ierson. Yeah.
Now, did you have any idea what was in these messages? I know they're in code, but I mean, did you know what were they?
No. Varying degrees of secrecy. I used to earwig the sergeant down at the station, and it was the middle of the night, and he phoned the officer's mess. I could hear this, you see, because the shack's in the officer's mess ground. So I listened, and he called for the duty officer, who dragged himself out of his pit. And the sergeant said, we've got a top secret message, sir. So the officer says, read it out to me. He says, sir, it's top secret. He says, I don't give a shit. Read it out to me. So that's how top secret it was. and I can't remember what it contained.
Now, so you'd be doing. Now, what was your living accommodation like? I mean, where were you living? Were you actually at Kaitak?
Yes, by the side of the runway, in these big concrete billets. Which
barrack box or pots?
No, these were big two-storey buildings, and obviously because of the summers, they were pretty well ventilated, big windows, and it was quite neat. There would be about eight of us to a room. And then for some unknown reason, they moved us into two-bed Nissen huts. Well, the Nissen huts actually contained four beds, but it had been partitioned so that there were two-bed units, which gave you a little more privacy if that's what you were after.
Reasonably comfortable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had a slave, you see, an armour. Little Chinese girl, they looked after us.
And what did the Chinese servants do for you? Or Batman, or whatever you want to call them?
Primarily, keep the billet clean, wash our bedding and our uniforms and our civvies. They were wonderful people. $10 Hong Kong dollars a fortnight we used to give them each. That was 12 and sixpence in real money. And, I got to be an absolute pig. My mother hated me when I came home.
We
put a uniform on in the morning. Yeah, by midday, it was soaked with sweat. So we just used to step out of it, leave it on the floor, and put a clean one on. And this armour used to tidy up after us, wash it, starch it, lay it out on the bed ready for us afterwards. And they do all our ironing. Well, I don't know. I discovered shirts used to have two little darts just behind the collar at the back. And to me, that's all they were. But no, these girls made them into pleats. And you'd have a wonderful pleated ribbon down the back of your shirt. And when I first got back, I tried to insist that my mother did that. As much chance of flying as a lead balloon in your dreams, Keith Glover. Yeah, and they'd make tea, you see. They'd get to know what watch you were on. And when it was time, they'd wake you up, and there'd be a big cup of hot sweet tea on your bedside locker. And again, they did all the washing up. They're wonderful. I've got a photograph.
Did you treat them well? I mean,
of course we did, yes.
Sometimes British soldiers can treat people harsh.
No, we did. They were human beings, and we respected them for it. They enjoyed it too, because they'd got the facilities of the camp. I don't know what sort of hovels some of them lived in. I mean, having gone around Hong Kong as I did, not necessarily in the bright light parts, but looking for... There were some horrendous conditions, and